You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome to Jeffrey. Jeffrey is a Berkman Center Fellow this year, and he's also the Perotti Chair in Italian and Comparative Literature at Stanford, as well as the founder of the Stanford Humanities Lab. And he's here today to talk about the Augmented Museum, and why don't you go from there, Jeffrey.
All right, thank you. I'm going to try to divide up this presentation evenly between two, maybe 12-minute segments. The first is going to be broadly about the question of why the World Wide Web and the metaverse matter to museums. And the second will be some examples of practice, because it's easy to preach, but I think in modeling visions of kind of augmentation of an institution as venerable and as rich as a museum, I think in a sense that's where the rubber hits the road. And as you'll see, that metaphor actually is pertinent to the main project that I'm going to talk about, which is a project that involves the repurposing of much like the High Line does in New York, of an abandoned portion of the urban infrastructure of a city. But I want to start more broadly with how I became interested in this particular question of how an institution of memory like a museum, and much of what I'm going to say I think is extensible to other institutions of memory like archives and libraries. So I'm gratified to see the collection of talent here representing those different institutions. But really what the kinds of challenges and opportunities that the reshaping of the public space that we associate with the web, but also with the web as it's moving, in my view at least, towards a kind of hybridity between the three-dimensional and the two-dimensional model that we're familiar with, the kind of realm of possibilities and challenges that institutions of memory will face, and how some of the ways, the rich and innovative ways, that they might confront those sets of challenges. I'm a cultural historian by training, actually a medievalist by training, believe it or not. But I was always a kind of slightly geeky humanist before the label digital humanist gained any currency, whatever currency it has. And for me, the main, what essentially shaped my own interest, particularly in museum spaces, is the sense that humanists working at the top of their sort of research game live in this very paradoxical world. And I think one feels that very acutely as a medievalist, not to mention an Italian medievalist, namely that the objects, the cultural objects, the corpora that you work on are of considerable interest to an audience. But it's an audience that would rarely, if probably you could pretty safely say never, pick up a publication. In other words, the knowledge distribution system that's associated with high-level humanities research in these different kinds of niche fields finds itself almost in a kind of structural, absolute structural segregation from possible audiences that could be interested in specialized knowledge that's produced within the walls of the academy. In other words, what has interested me with regard to the museum space is that museums are under a kind of constraint to communicate to audiences that are hybrid, heterogeneous audiences. University museums in particular have the task of interpreting, serving as mediators between the sort of work that goes on inside the core research and teaching section of a university and a broader set of audiences. And I think the idea of linking reflection on the prospects for augmenting our understanding of the museum space as such a kind of a bridge space, if you like, looked at particularly from the standpoint of the digital turn, it seems to me like a very interesting set of, it poses a very interesting set of questions about how research at the highest level in different kinds of humanities fields might perhaps once again, like it did maybe more likely 100 years ago, communicate with audiences that would never pick up a scholarly monograph or pick up a specialized journal. So my interest in the digital more broadly, but in museums particularly, has to do with the whole issue of creating new models of public culture, essentially. And as you'll see, that's the vision that shapes the set of questions I want to talk about here. Museums themselves as institutions are undergoing a radical transformation even as we speak, and that transformation involves a transformation of the notion of the visitor experience itself as a kind of core experience, in other words, the nature of that experience. It involves transformation in the meaning of location. The old sort of bricks and mortar based model of identity, I think, is increasingly under pressure from other kinds of notions of institutional identity. And it's also, these institutions like museums are facing a tremendous set of challenges that have specifically to do with shifting concepts of with regard to the practice of collecting, preserving, and disseminating, which are, of course, fundamental defining features of these institutions. With regard to the visitor experience, one of the things that I think has fundamentally changed is that whereas physical presence, whether it's presence within the bricks and mortar structure of a museum itself or an archive or a library, or its physical presence before the core set of objects of which an institution like a museum is a custodian, is no longer the norm. In other words, we can no longer assume that it is the entire object of the activity of the institution. There are so many different kinds of presence that the very notion of the visitor experience, I think, has been, in a sense, deterritorialized. Visitation itself has increasingly become less an experience that begins and ends with entering and exiting a physical structure. It has a kind of pre-phase often, through forms of tele-access or telepresence, you might say, and a kind of post-presence that goes beyond increasingly simply what has traditionally been the way of documenting the kind of content, the kind of materials that an exhibition consists in, namely the print-based catalog. So there's a specific set of challenges that have to do with interpreting that new temporality, which is much more fluid between a visitor experience in the flesh, so to speak, and those forms of access that precede and succeed a visitation. And last but not least, shifting expectations and indeed needs with regard to the levels of interaction with the kinds of objects that of which museums are custodians. The dominant forms of musical culture, other kinds of popular culture that are more process-oriented rather than product-oriented, the increasing familiarity and expectation on the part of visitors to have some kind of mode of engagement that goes beyond experiencing an original object in a glass case, for instance, I think are all creating kind of horizons of expectation and need that are fundamentally different with regard to the role of institutions like museums. The second point, I think, is maybe the most self-evident one, and that is that even often in the case of these the more traditional bricks and mortar notions of what a museum is, that notion itself, connected to ideas about membership, about community, is itself been radically shifted over the course of the last 50 years by the pervasiveness of travel, the mobility, social mobility, of the physical mobility of people, such that if you look, for instance, at the demographics of membership groups of museums today, I was looking at an NEA study on this subject. It's interesting how the percentage of people who do not live in the physical area of the institutions to which they belong has actually increased by something like 3 times over the course of the last 30, 40 years. That is a trend that is likely to expand over time. So that the very notion of a museum and who it serves, what its community is itself becoming increasingly both a local fact that's an abiding fact, but also one that has a kind of global, an increasingly global, if you like, dimension that's inescapable. Last but not least, of course, and implicit in what I said before, is the multiplication of modes of offsite access and presence, the way in which exhibitions and other kinds of programming themselves are increasingly have expanded out into other non-print-based realms of communication, obviously, particularly the World Wide Web. But anybody who's a museum professional who's in the room can, I think, attest to the tremendous challenge that even sustaining a kind of substantial commitment to maintaining web-based resources, that represents for museums, given the other substantial challenges that they face with regard to being custodians of large and rich and usually hyperbolically large corpora of objects, corpora that are far beyond their just physical processing, ordering, storing abilities. So when you add the web on as this new extended dimension, you create, I think, a challenge that most museums find to be a rather overwhelming challenge, which isn't to say that there aren't interesting and innovative things going on in that realm, but they represent a real institutional challenge in terms of priorities. Last but not least, the area of collecting, preserving, and disseminating. The traditional definitions of institutions of memory very much focused on the idea of the vault. That's the reason I have a picture of the dial on a bank vault, which is to say that preservation happens by protecting objects, protecting corpora from end users, you might say. And there's some very noble and dignified reasons for doing so. But we also have, I think, a whole set of new opportunities to rethink models of preservation. They're access-driven rather than access-based, rather than based on creating scarcity, if you like, or creating distance. And this challenge is not just a kind of passing challenge. It also is embedded in the nature of the kinds of archives and materials that are arriving increasingly and becoming challenges of preservation and dissemination within museums themselves. Namely, I've been involved in a couple of projects. One of them was on the Buckminster Fuller Archive. When the Buckminster Fuller Archive arrived at Stanford, it weighed 40 tons, and it was made up of about 4,000 hours of recorded sound in every conceivable audio format in the history of the 20th century, 1,000 hours of video, ditto, physical structures that had been dismantled and put in boxes, 15,000-20,000 photographs, Bucky Fuller's Dymaxion chronophile, his life story in 15-minute segments for large sections, because he conceived of his life as a laboratory experiment. The question is, what do you do with an archive like that? Well, actually, the answers are not so self-evident. Traditional preservation models find themselves confronted by the enormous challenges and costs that would be associated with a traditional approach. I think that there's some interesting kinds of experiments going on that have to do precisely with how such corpora might be treated. The Library of Congress did an experiment, for instance, with crowdsourcing the tagging of a section of the American Memory Project. And I think if I'm remembering correctly what they told me, they actually they were able to process about 500-600 photographs in at almost no cost within a matter of months that would have taken them, I think the estimate was something like $30,000 to $40,000 of staff time to actually process simply by posting them on Flickr. So there are some interesting and innovative possibilities occurring, precisely hovering around these three key missions that museums and libraries perform. In addition, these are institutions where a lot of the content, the rich experiences that they sustain, produce, nourish, are lost by a print-based model of communication. In other words, if the catalog is the only thing you walk away from a very rich physical installation of a kind of argument made through a set of objects, you're coming away with maybe an artifact that's rich in its own terms, but it's also denatured with respect to the spatiality, for instance, of your experience of an exhibition space. A lot of the work, and some of the work I'm going to show you that I've been involved in, involves also thinking about how we could create archival records, if you like, of events that are richer than the kind of traditional print-based model of what such records might look like. So what is an augmented museum? How do I imagine the notion of the augmented museum? The first thing is, I think that it is an institution that has porous walls. In other words, where the boundary line between inside and outside is far more porous than in the more traditional definition. And second of all, as a result of this sort of this increasing fluidity about the before and the after, or the inside and the outside, it's also an institution that's on a public square that could be as small as the local community that serves, but also as big as a global audience where most of the members are unlikely to ever physically set foot in the bricks and mortar institution. And I think as a function of those first two observations, it's also defined as much by its physical programming, which were once its core, as it is by the exploration But the creation of natively digital or shall we say augmented physical content that also circulates in a kind of secondary form. I think it's an institution also that's defined by its explorations of fusions, as I say here in the slide, and frictions between the physical and the digital. It multi-purposes and multi-channels everything that it does. In other words, the fact that one produces print catalogs does not exclude that one could produce digital extensions of those print catalogs, or indeed duplicates of it. You could have a kind of multiplicity of lives for a single set of artifacts that are the artifacts that you provide visitors with as a support for their experiences. And it's an institution that's that is trying to address one of the major challenges that museums, and I'm sure all the museum professionals in the room can attest to, which is the fact that the museum demographic, particularly in certain categories of museums, history museums I think are due pretty much the worst, is a very senior demographic. The NEA statistics, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, show that the average age of a museum visitor hovers somewhere around in the late 50s, early 60s, I believe, is the correct figure. Zoos and botanical gardens do the best in terms of the younger audiences. Art and history museums do the worst. Next, but I think crucially, it's a place where research, where the very process by which, whether it's a curatorial process or processes of conservation and preservation, all of those activities that make up the museum are now on view. They're part of the show. They're no longer something that precedes the delivery of a final product, but they become integral to the experience of what it is to enter this the physical space of the museum, as well as its various extensions. And as part of that very conception, I think it's important to think about how planning processes, curation itself, the design of exhibitions could itself become part of this narrative about pre, during, and post. Not a kind of secret set of activities that then give rise to a product that's delivered from above as a kind of final end experience with all the filtering, all the decision making made in advance. But rather, process becomes part of the product, if you like, and vice versa. As part of that, as an extension, a kind of natural consequence of that, I think, is the notion also of a kind of more interactive model of how visitors are asked to engage with these various activities that characterize a museum as a space. I've been, in my own work, I've been experimenting with a bunch of different genres of like what the world of museum show genres might look like in a universe where museums are now augmented in the kinds of directions that I'm talking about. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but I'm just going to mention a couple of them. One of them is the idea of experimenting with modalities of exhibition that that change, essentially shift the scale of what we can do by either imagining configurations of institutions that work together to create kind of bridge exhibitions where, for instance, digital content serve as a kind of a trait d'union, a kind of link between different kinds of physical sites, or even exhibitions that are in non-traditional spaces but linked to more traditional physical exhibitions, or even the experiments with linking the world outside the museum to the world inside the museum. One of the Humanities Lab's early experimental projects was a project that where we Hewlett-Packard had already developed a series of handheld devices that had GPS capabilities and so forth. And one of my colleagues was curating a show on the history of Asian American art, and we had this idea it would be really interesting to curate the landscape of San Francisco, have a group of historians curate the landscape of San Francisco as the external extension of the show that was inside the De Young Museum. Unfortunately, De Young is a little bit far from Chinatown, for those of you who know San Francisco, but I think those kinds of ideas of thinking about how what's inside and outside are placed in a kind of interactive relationship, and where there isn't this sense of discontinuity, if you like, where you step into a kind of magic box and then you step outside of it. Augmentation as a notion here means a number of different things. One of the things it means is to animate physical originals that are inaccessible, difficult. The fragment of papyrus that signifies only to a very small community of people, but that's an extremely interesting object in its physicality. It's not about substituting that aura or that kind of magic of that physicality of the original, but rather finding ways to get it to speak. And there are many interesting, I think, approaches to that. They could include creating digital versions of these physical artifacts that are manipulable or that are tagged in such a way that one can place that physical object in relation to, let's say, a manipulable 3D version that's tagged with the kinds of conversations or debates that go on within a scholarly community of experts, the few people who can read that object or who are engaged in a kind of discussion about its meaning. That meaning has to do with what papyrus factory produced it or the literary text that it's a fragment of. I think the key issue is here is experimenting. There are no, I think we're in an era when these models are just beginning to become, they're different, emerging sort of paradigms for how this process might work. But I think that we have a tremendous opportunity to break down the barrier between specialized knowledge about objects and that experience of them in their physicality. And so in my mind, at least, the challenge is really about creating those kind of value-added experiences where one can augment the experience of the physical and also extend that experience to remote forms of access as well. So now I want to turn in the final couple of minutes to some examples of practice. I've been involved in a bunch of exhibition projects that have tried in one way or another to explore this emerging territory. The first was a project called the Crowds Project, and I'm not going to go into it in any great detail, but it was an attempt to try to think of what a print plus model of a large-scale collaborative humanities scholarship might look like, with one output being an exhibition very narrowly crafted around an archive, which was the Hoover Institution poster collection. 100,000 objects, way too many objects to be processed. They're not worth enough to make it worth your time to process every single one. 30,000 of them were classified, 70,000 we don't know anything about. We just know they came in rolls and boxes, you know, and they're sitting in piles. So we did a very large exhibition project with a group of undergraduates looking at 30, 40,000 of them, kind of crafted an exhibition experience out of them, and linked it to a very large-scale book, which is a book on the history, the role of multitudes in modern life, from the revolutions of the 18th century to the present, which was itself an experiment with the genre of the scholarly book, with a web-based resource in between as the bridge, the most extended version of the book, and the bridge to a whole series of other contents that are natively digital, to just try out this hypothesis. The second was a project called Life Squared, which was an experiment with archiving categories of culture that are weakly captured by traditional methods of archival preservation. Example, a site-specific artwork, the first site-specific artwork on the West Coast, done in around 1970 by a prominent feminist artist, who's still a very prominent figure today, Lynn Hirschman. The idea was, what do you do with a site-specific artwork? A site-specific artwork is inherently a non-object-based, it's an event-based model of culture. You can put together notebooks with, you know, photographs, newspaper reports, etc., but that's a very weak kind of capture of a cultural moment that actually was much richer and more interesting. So we did a hybrid project where we built not a replica, but out of archival paper-based materials, we built an experiential counterpart to this site-specific artwork, which was an experience carried out in a hotel in downtown San Francisco called the Dante Hotel, just by coincidence. We built it in Second Life, on an island in Second Life, and then we did a series of physical exhibitions where we embedded the Second Life reconstruction in the physical exhibition space, and then we did replicas of the installations in different sites in Second Life as well, so as to create this kind of contamination between these digital replicas built out of actual archival photographs, but that were created a kind of skeleton experience of the actual physical site and the history of the circulation and reception of the reconstructed artwork. The third project is the one I'm going to focus on mostly. It is a project that involves combines industrial archaeology with the repurposing of an abandoned portions of the urban infrastructure of the city of Trento in northern Italy, and an experiment with creating a new typology of history museum that's supported by an island in Second Life once again. And then last but not least, an experiment with the additioning of actual physical exhibitions and the use of virtual worlds, rather the 3D web, as a system for integrating physical exhibitions that are in multiple sites. But before turning to those, I just want to mention a couple of other future projects that I'm involved with that are relevant to this question. One of them is, I'll talk about the tunnels in a second, but it has to do with categories of objects that typically in museum practice have not been very rewarding, shall we say, to visitors, like certain areas of decorative arts, like fashion history. I actually find fashion history as a historian extremely interesting, but I've never seen an exhibition where looking at a dress under glass was nearly as rich as actually holding a piece of fabric in my hand is rich as an experience. There's something sensorially weak about these sorts of exhibitional models that have prevailed in that sector. And so I'm engaged right now in a project focused on the history of Milanese fashion, where we're trying to invent some kind of display prototypes that would allow you to work with three-dimensional models of dresses that were historical dresses, and to place the physical object in relation to a back-projected, manipulable, three-dimensional digital version of those dresses, but that have been tagged and annotated by people with expert knowledge about everything from the use of the dress, its representation in the contemporary fashion press, to the way the seams are put together. You can turn it around, turn it inside out, look at how it looks from the inside out. You can do everything except, of course, pull it out of the display case and wear it. But the point is to try to experiment with how we make certain kinds of categories of objects that are not typically well captured by a conventional exhibition methods available. And not only how we do that, but how we also create contents that then have a second life, which is a life as part of the archive, part of a fashion archive, through the 2D web. Windows that open up and allow you to perform the same experiment without the presence of the physical object. I mentioned the crowds project, so I'm going to jump over that. I just wanted to show that it involved also the creation of physical objects, the building of these media stations that were designed by the Latvian constructivist Gustav Klutsis for the streets of Moscow, never built. We actually built them into the physical exhibition, and then they're part of the web based learning environment that was built around the project, as well as all of the technical drawings, the history of their reconstruction, and so on. I want to talk now about speed limits, and then I'll close with the tunnel project. The idea with the speed limits project was to link together three physical exhibitions that are discontinuous in time and space via a virtual world platform. It's not actually a virtual world platform. It's actually a virtual world environment that can be embedded in the 2D web. So, in other words, this is not like a gated, walled garden type of virtual world context. Rather, this is a way of deploying 3D spaces in a 2D web environment, in a browser environment, in other words. And the idea here was to take three physical exhibitions. Two of the exhibitions are actually the same exhibition in two different physical sites. The Canadian Center for Architecture Speed Limits show, which closed in November, actually, of 2009. It's Miami version at the Wolfsonian, which will be starting up in at the end of 2010, and then a second show, which is not directly related, which is a monographic show on Jais Nielsen, the only Danish futurist, or the leading one, I guess, by definition, right? A show that was done at the Bornholms Kunstmuseum, an island museum closer to Sweden than to main to the Danish peninsula. And to try to experiment with how you could place these shows that have different timelines, have different, they have some shared content, but very limited shared content, in a relation to one another, through this hybrid 2D, 3D web approach. So the experiment was carried out by creating a Sericata-based archival quality replica of each of the shows. which exists in multiple versions. One version is the archival version, which is faithful to the actual physical installation with all of the particulars, including wall labels, every single distinctive attribute of the experience you would have had walking through the galleries. The second is a version of that which is editable for end users. In other words, visitors were invited to recurate the show. So there's a kind of curator mode, which allows you to take that same model and to use it as a kind of experimental platform to engage in the very activity that produced the end show, including objects that were excluded, the basement, what you didn't see, what was not chosen by the curators for a series of reasons. And then to, in addition to those resources, to create a whole series of natively digital resources that either involve installation pieces that exist only on this sort of virtual square around which these different shows are assembled, these replicas, interactive, non-interactive versions of these shows are assembled, and can be expanded over time, where they can live over a longer duration than the duration of any physical exhibition. So this is just one example of that kind of exhibition. And one of the ideas that we had is that it would be interesting to have additioning of these physical replicas, just like you have additioning of books or other kinds of artistic projects. In other words, wouldn't it be interesting if 20 years from now you might want to remix a show that you did and you have a perfect archival copy of it, as well as 3,000 visitor-produced interpretations of the show that are recurated. So that's the kind of world, I think, that the Augmented Museum points toward. This was carried out in a kind of very experimental fashion here, simply to really develop the Sirikata platform itself. And I'm not going to be able to show you very much of that, but I want to close here by talking about the tunnels project, because it's another example, an early example. I mean, it's not an example from a technology standpoint that's hugely challenging, but I think it poses an interesting set of possibilities precisely that go in the direction of this sort of augmented vision of what a museum, particularly a history museum, can do. The site of the Trento Tunnels project is at the entrance to the city of Trento. There's a cliff that overlooks the city. These were the two tunnels that in the late 1960s, in a kind of heroic gesture of urban renewal, were carved through the mountain face, destroying one of the great sort of historic proletarian neighborhoods of the city, you know, kind of major urban renewal scar, in order to give highway access right to the center of the city to people coming in and exiting the city. They were closed in the late 1990s after they lived their, you know, sort of 20 years of useful life, and sat dormant for the next almost 10 years with many doubts about what would actually be done with them. They are two parallel 320-meter tunnels. They're 7,000 square meters. It's about as big as a wing of the Louvre. They're absolutely enormous structures. The idea of doing an experiment was first broached in the context of actually the president of the region had visited one of the Holocaust museums in Israel that was built into a tunnel, was kind of fascinated by the structure and thought of these tunnels. And the Trentino is a region, because it's split linguistically and culturally between German speakers and Italian speakers and other minority groups, it has this very kind of tense sort of history of coexistence and conflict between these different groups. And like most regions that have that kind of history, it has a huge network of local history museums with only one problem. Nobody goes to them. The people find them boring. They have rich repositories of material, but they've never found a way to create a kind of experience that attracts people, brings them back to those institutions over and over again. So the idea here was to create a laboratory for experimenting with what a history museum might look like that people would want to come to, essentially, and that would serve as a node in a larger network of history museums within the region. And this very unusual site, namely these two tunnels, as the location, really their novelty, if you like, as a sort of setting, was thought to be both a challenge but also an opportunity. So in 2008, a group that I'm associated with, of multimedia producers and the Stanford Humanities Lab and a group of graphic artists and an architect most of whom are based in either the Trentino Alto Adige or in other parts of Italy. We built this first project, which was an attempt to create a living archive of World War I in these two spaces. And as you can see, the solution that was adopted was to take the notion of World War I as the first black and white war. In other words, where photography and cinema were both, in a sense, central to the notion of the memory of the war. As a figure that we literalized in the construction of an itinerary, it's a long itinerary. It's almost a kilometer walk through the tunnels and then back out the other tunnel. The black tunnel was turned into a kind of phantasmagoria, like a kind of gallery of projections with all kinds of theatrical tricks and so forth, but all made out of archival materials. In other words, where you have the archive as this sort of immersive environment that takes you down through the tunnel, through the years of the war, year by year by year, but with the events of the war told from the bottom up by ordinary people. There's no generals. There are no great battles. Simply how the years of World War I were lived by ordinary people in the region in multiple languages through a soundscape and a series of projections. And then when you exited and came back into the White Tunnel, you went through a series of structures that actually showed you can see the whole map of the itinerary, that actually marked the different moments in the institutionalization of the memory of World War I, from the immediate post-war to the present. And there are a series of other features of this, but the idea here was really to try to create an experience that would balance something experiential, something emotive, but based on actual archival materials, with instead the more scientific, traditional, documentary ideas about how you document the events of history. And you had these two phases. And the one kind of novel feature of this was that, as you can see from the snapshot from Second Life, the support, the apparatus, was in a virtual world. In other words, the immersive experience that you had in the black tunnel, actually, if you wanted to find out exactly what you saw and play the clip and see where it came from and see who it was that was speaking, it's all in the virtual world. And that virtual world was used, the island was used also as a development site for educational programs, for other kinds of, there's a library on it, there are a series of film archives, period film archives, that allow people to use, to revisit the exhibition from the perspective of somebody interested in the nature of the documentary, the archival, and so forth. In other words, you might say reversing what you'd expect of the relationship between a virtual copy, a digital copy, and the physical experience. This year, in 2009, we did a second edition of the tunnels that has a similar sort of, a different but similar structure, which is a kind of encyclopedia, an alphabet, like a giant children's book unfolded the whole course of the tunnel around themes that are central to the identity of the region in the 20th century. So what you're seeing here are simply, this is the alphabet, which is made up of themes that run from autonomy to volunteerism and Zambano, which is a town that was destroyed in a major disaster and then rebuilt. And in each of these letters, there's an installation using a combination of basically didactic supports, chronology, a narrative, and so forth, and a series of films projected on the ground, projected on the sidewalls, and so forth. And while I'm finishing up here, I'm not going to put the sound on. I'm going to play just a film that'll run in the back here, where it gives you a little bit more of a feeling for how the actual physical experience is of this exhibition space. Now, the Second Life version on the island in Second Life is, of course, the 2008 edition. So you can still, we have a version of the 2008 experience, which allows you to go back and revisit how the spaces were used in the first edition. And we're currently building the 2009. So the idea, again, is to play with this idea that these contents that you create that usually would be lost, except for photographs, site photographs or video or so forth, that they actually become, they can coexist side by side.
We're building the 2009
edition like that? We're building the Second Life version.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So the
2009, 2010, because it actually is ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but the idea is that, in other words, these exhibitions, which otherwise would be successive, have a kind of simultaneity to them. They become a set of objects that can be placed side by side with one another. Yeah. And what you're seeing here, this is from the 2008 version, these original, the inauguration shots of the 2008, where you can see the black tunnel, the Phantasmagoria, which now only exists in Second Life. And this will then transition into sequences from the 2009-2010 edition, the one that's up currently. If you went to Trento through the end of 2010, you will find it up and running. I haven't said very much about technology. I mean, the speed limits experiment is built with a virtual environment called Sirocata, which is an open source virtual world platform that we've been building at Stanford between the computer scientists and the graphics group and the Stanford Humanities Lab. There's a bunch of other trickery involved in some of the other kind of more installation-based work that we've done in terms of augmenting the experience of objects. But a lot of the time, I think that the real challenges have to do really with design more than they have to do with specifically developing new technology approaches. In other words, it's really finding the rich ways of creating that kind of relation of both support and friction, if you like, between digital objects and physical objects. And that's really the area that that has continued to interest me, and it certainly is going to inform this larger set of projects focusing on the decorative arts, in particularly the whole issue of fashion, archives of fashion history. And I'm going to stop there and leave the video running. Go ahead.
I think one of the challenges, it seems to me, of taking this type of material and putting it into digital or even analog form is how to preserve it so that somebody 10, 15, 40, 400 years from now can still access this material. Because, you know, things that are physical artifacts can last a long time if they're kept, if people take good care of them. Even paper can last a long time if they take good care of it. A wire recording from 100 years ago is very hard to deal with these days, and a website today might not be very usable 50 years from now. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's of course, it's really one of those core concerns that it has really, you know, I think in the best possible way been a defining feature of the mission of an institution like a museum. And I think I don't think that in my view the relationship between traditional models of preservation and the digital is not a kind of, it's certainly not an either or, but rather how one can best integrate. It's sort of an and, but an and that needs to be also, I think, still much. I still think that it's an and that needs much greater definition. And one of the challenges, for instance, on this fashion archive project that we've been thinking about is the issue of fabric, of texture. That if you want to add sensorial richness to an experience, of course, digital artifacts can be very denaturing with regard to many of those sensorial attributes. But that's not necessarily because one can't find interesting and imaginative approaches. I think it's more often because these aren't the issues that are of interest to an engineer, which is why putting humanists, curators and other people, museum professionals, or artists for that matter. I mean, a lot of our practice involves bringing artists into a mix where there's technologists and artists and historians side by side at the same table. That I think that the what's an interesting question to me might not be an interesting question to an engineer. But sometimes if you ask an engineer, well, like, what would you do? Like, how do you do the scanning of fabrics, for instance, that would give you a sense of what the physicality of that material might be. There are some interesting technology questions there, as it turns out, of course. And so I think preservation and digital extensions of the physical can be actually very interestingly linked, depending on the nature of the objects, depending on the nature of the challenges. I don't see them as mutually exclusive. But what I do think is that the kinds of traditional models of preservation that have prevailed are under serious pressure, and even one might say in crisis, because of just the sheer vastness of the corpora that are arriving even as we speak into so many institutions that are engaged in the task of preservation. So I think we have to think about models somehow that go beyond. I mean, I think that one of the virtues of digital objects is, of course, their reproducibility. And so the proliferation, at least, of digital copies is actually can be made into a guarantee also for some kind of preservation. Maybe it's not full preservation. It depends on your criteria. But yeah, jump in.
Well, hello.
Yeah.
My name is Fish Fishman, and in Second Life, I'm actually known as Tuna Oddfellow. And I started in Second Life in August of 2005 as a magician, asking the question, how do you create a sense of wonder? How do you create a sense of wow in a space where the first thing people learn how to do is fly? How do you create a magical experience, and how do you immerse somebody? And this is something that people are constantly working on. And actually, I'm going to fast forward to about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, the MacArthur Foundation, which has a presence in Second Life, decided that they would put a grant out for a number of Second Life artists. And myself and Shava Nirad, my partner, both were commissioned to create this piece of art called, and this was actually all being done for issues of social justice. So you had to create a piece of art and make it an immersive experience. Well, that was my rules, that it had to be immersive anyway, and happen and experience this within Second Life. So we created this piece called Every Day We Tend to the Eternal Flames of Justice. And you actually walk into the space, and because you're immersed, because you're an avatar, you get an experience that would cost, you know, millions of dollars to really implement it in real space. But in the virtual space, you're just consumed by the bigness of what you're inside of. And you're looking at, basically, you're standing on barbed wire, and all around you are different images of social injustices that are going on in the world. And if you click on each panel, there'll be a story that goes with it that tells you what it's like. So you actually feel like you're inside of this 40-meter sphere museum, but actually you're sitting in front of your computer. And people actually, because of the heaviness of the topic, people actually would sit there and want to spend a lot of time there just absorbing it and sucking it in and meditating. And you can't convey those kinds of experiences necessarily using physical medium at an economical cost, but I can create it in space like that. So I'm very, very interested in how this continues to evolve, because at this point I'm a digital artist who's finding different ways to preserve and present my history.
I mean, I think the great, we've been involved in, you know, experiments with the Linden Lab folks really from the beginning of Second Life, and our main source of frustration, the reason we went off and built our own virtual world, basically, is that is the gated, you know, the gated garden problem, which is for museums, for institutions like museums, the importability and exportability of objects in standard file formats suddenly makes the investment so much more fundamentally justifiable. Not to mention, if you're an artist, you don't want to have your contents locked down in a world where, you know, if tomorrow Linden Labs pulls the plug, you know, that's pretty much it. It's gone.
All sorts of tools and systems for that. Yeah. As an artist, we have them. It'll be a pain to make it happen, but
yeah, exactly.
You know.
So, I mean, that's been for us a real source of frustration, and we also think that the 3D and the 2D web are not far from being rivals to one another. What the really interesting space is how they coexist and how they interact. So, I mean, I could show you some, or if anybody who's more geekly in their interest wants to see some demos of how Sericata works, you know, as an in-browser virtual world, I can show you. But I think that, you know, the idea of access in the inside-outside, you know, exportability, importability of what you create, which is also the guarantee that you can, let's say your perfect archival model of your bricks and mortar structure becomes a reusable model that each time you do something, you can animate the way you want, or you can let other people animate it. That kind of multiplication of possibilities is something that, you know, that's where the value added really starts to kick in my view. You know, yeah.
It seems like there's a paradox or a tension in between curating and consuming, where consumers expect that the things curated for them are some comprehensive set. And, you know, I find watching people in museums as interesting as looking at the objects. And I see that there's this tendency for museum goers to feel that they must consume everything. Or they would take a tour, an audio tour, where they're said, you know, make sure you see these 10 things and know these 100 facts about those 10 things. And I'm wondering how you deal with the tension, the potential problem of overwhelming this audience who don't want to feel like the possibilities are limitless. That's a defeat for them, really, in visiting a curated space.
No, that's an excellent question, and I think you know, museums have codified the right balance between, you know, sort of too much information, too little information. Sure. American museums, in particular, I think, for American museum frequenters, when they go over to Europe and go to some of the major, it's less true now than it was 10 years ago, but it's still true. Major museums overseas. Often they're really surprised at how little hand-holding there is. I mean, there's, you know, in terms of wall labels, I think American museums have often struck the right balance. But that is a real question. I think one of the exciting opportunities I see is the possibility that the museum experience, precisely in this augmented kind of expanded vision, becomes one that's much more customizable than the conventional top-down model, which is prevalent today. In other words, where all these decisions have been made about how you're going to experience a sequence of objects. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that. On the contrary, it's an art, as anybody who's ever curated anything knows. It's really an art to tell a story through a set of objects. Yet, at the same time, there are sometimes many stories. So the question is of how you might, the example of the Fashion Museum, Fashion History Museum is one I've been thinking about a lot, naturally, because we're in the sort of brainstorming stage about how this might work. But what kind of story does a dress tell? Well, it tells a lot of stories. It tells stories about social history, about gender. It tells stories about the materials that make it up. It tells stories about the techniques that went into the construction of that artifact. It tells stories about the careers of the designer. How do you capture all of those stories? Well, you know, with a traditional curatorial approach, you can't capture them all. You choose which is the dominant story, and then you try to weave in those other. But I think that the augmented version allows for you to maybe think of a world where you tell multiple stories. Obviously, there's a lot of design and editing and thinking about how you make those multiple stories not create a kind of cacophony. But and that's the challenge. So you're still stuck with the challenge, but I think you're also operating in an environment where suddenly it becomes possible to create a more participatory model of how a visitor experience could be constructed, where if what you really want to learn about is how seams were made, that's the narrative that you can choose to experience. But if you really want to know about how ideas about female identity were shaped by certain dressmaking practices, that's the narrative you can follow. So, I mean, that's what interests me, is how the kind of richness of the layering could be constructed to sort of have it both ways, if you like. Yeah, Doc.
Actually, we have some fellows from other museums here. I was wondering how this strikes you guys.
On that note, it's absolutely fascinating. Touched on a lot of different levels, and I'd sort of love to continue communications on that. Maybe having visit, and actually, there's certain projects which I'd love to get a little bit of insight, kind of feedback about. You know, the Peabody is a sort of extreme example of a certain kind of museum. I mean, the Peabody Museum, originally of American Archaeology, was founded in the 1860s to collect the material of the vanishing Native American people. So the original premise of this institution is that if you collect this material, these people are vanishing and there's maybe nothing we can do about that, but we're gonna collect the stuff, so we'll be fine. And then moved into, Africa in the period preceding World War I for various reasons, and then the Pacific Islands, the period mostly preceding World War II. This has a lot to do with notions of what is important ethnographic material. You know, this this maybe increasingly sort of myth that, you know, material created in the absence of market forces and stuff like that is what we really find to be important. And the PVD, obviously, the collections are has enormous archaeological components to them as well, and had to do with what people at Harvard were studying. But anyway, so, you know, we find this fascinating. I mean, not the least for which that, you know, we're increasingly working with students, and that although we find that, you know, the demographic absolutely accurate in terms of the age of people that come to the museum, aside from the school kids that we have coming through who we do almost no programming for at all. I mean, we have a educational thing which runs sort of parallel, but I mean, I've been involved in the development of every exhibition to people for the last 20 years. We don't develop exhibitions for children. Yeah. And but at the same time, we work intensively with Harvard students and engaging them. And I think my notions of it, I'm a 45-year-old person that has absolutely no sort of technology kind of savvy at all. And so my notions of how to really engage these people are, you know, many, many steps behind in some way.
I'm at the Smithing Museum, and something I started there actually in August. And it's a museum based on biblical archaeology. Again, a lot of the same issues. Started in different notions than archaeology today. The collection was meant to be exhibited in-house, and the museum has gone through various life and contracted and expanded. But space was a big issue, certainly now, where some of the building has been taken over by offices. And something I brought in, sort of as a medium step, I guess, towards something as grand as a three-dimensional world that you can wander through, three-dimensional museum, is bringing in a digital display where we can put up small exhibits of the massive amount of material that's in our collection right now, but we just can't put on display because the building is so small. But we can put up digital images of these objects and create small stories that people can sort of sit through passively and watch. It's not quite as active as mm-hmm. being able to control and experience it as your world. But it's trying to bridge a little bit of this older view of what a museum is and perhaps what the current visitors are expecting out of a museum. And it seems to be well received so far.
I mean, the notion of participatory curatorship, which is, I didn't explicitly designate here, but it's a notion that I've been very interested in experimenting with, is obviously something that's a lot easier to carry out with digital objects than it would be with your physical objects, because of, obviously, in addition to all the conservation space, et cetera, issues, it opens up a kind of interesting Pandora's box, where perhaps with communities like a university community, where you have students, sometimes with some expertise, even in a field, if you thought of the teaching, of your teaching mission as being fulfilled by getting people engaged in curatorship, rather than the more traditional definitions of what classroom-based learning are, suddenly you have this kind of extended dimension for your own activities, because there are always going to be large numbers of collections, as all the professionals in the room know, that will sit in boxes. They are just destined to do so, because there's not enough space, because for a million reasons. There's never enough time or resources to do everything. And that situation is going to continue to expand exponentially over the next 50 to 100 years. As you know, you just see the sheer redundancy, the level of redundancy in archival materials today. I've been actively involved myself in processing some archives. Because of the ease with which reproductions can be produced. The Fuller Archive is a perfect case in point. I'd say about 30% of the archive is all just redundancy, but you can't throw anything out. You're not allowed to do it. So what do you do? I think that's where this sort of idea of curatorship itself as a form of scholarship and training could really offer some tremendous leverage for museums themselves to do things that they can't naturally do, and also then to create programming that has a life of a public life. I mean, I think it's an exciting set of opportunities, especially with collections that are difficult collections, that aren't where the degree of access is not self-evident. I had an interesting conversation with somebody, one of the meetings we were at, Alexander, about there's this project going on of like the archaeology of Harvard Yard, imagine an experience, and John and I were talking about this in passing, where with some kind of ubiquitous computing device, you can walk around the Harvard campus and actually experience the physical landscape as it is today in relation to what was found, what's been found underground over the course of 40, 50 years of digs that have gone on from place to place. Maybe many of those objects may be in your basement, right? Right, exactly. So suddenly that starts to look like a really interesting equation where somebody who comes as a tourist to the campus suddenly is experiencing that landscape in a different way, and they might actually want suddenly to really go to see the stuff, so to speak, in the Peabody in a way that they're unlikely to if they just see it as an archaeology exhibition, right? So I don't know. These are configurations that are, I think, really rich and new sorts of opportunities for creating different relationships between a bricks and mortar institution and the place that it belongs, not to mention the off-site forms of access, obviously, as well.
I've been curious about museums putting up on the web high-density digital files of some of the two-dimensional objects that they're known for. I mean, I talked to a guy at the Getty once about this. You know, take any painting that they love. What if you put up a digital file such that anybody could reproduce it at whatever level they wanted, given the equipment they had, for free? Mm-hmm. So I think that would fall into your bailiwick here. Would one find resistance to this? Do museums not want to do it?
I'm probably not the one to answer this, but I'm sure. It's a real can of worms because.
We'll talk about the worms.
Yeah. Okay. Listen. You want to know about the worms? Yeah. Maybe I should let some of you in the room speak about this. For many institutions, there's a substantial income stream associated with permissions. So, the first point of resistance would, of course, be the relationship, the proprietary relationship, or at least the rights issues connected to certain categories of objects, especially. But I don't know. I'd prefer that people who are the the museum professionals address this question.
My initial proposal to the Getty was to just take one object as an experiment and to see. There's permissions, but also many museums don't feel. You know, what is the permission stream actually?
Right.
It's a huge can of worms, and even when you're creating a virtual exhibit, you run into the same issues of you want this to be something which, you know, 10 years from now, you can still use, and not going to suddenly have someone go, actually, no, you can't use that piece. So we had to go and find all sorts of creative common images and writings to go with what we were doing, so that we can, mostly it was Creative Commons images and our writing. But to be able to have people be allowed to view this and have this go someplace else at some point, you have to think about that. And it's really hard when you deal with art in the real world, whether or not it's going to be allowed to be exhibited, or even, you know, history in the real world.
It's a huge can of worms. I mean, basically, the rule that we've adopted at the Stanford Humanities Lab, the rule we've adopted is we never consult the university lawyers. We proceed on the assumption that these are all money-losing projects, right? And that we create value, and therefore, we create value for the artifacts, the physical artifacts, rather than diminish their commercial value. And we've never been challenged in that stance, but my colleagues at the law school told me early on, don't go to the university lawyers. it's a very delicate issue for museums that depend often to a considerable degree on the income streams associated with the selling of permissions and rights and so forth, especially in certain categories of objects, obviously. It's less so when you're in an archaeology museum, you may be pretty much free to choose as you will to grant degrees of full access, limited access, but you know, if you're dealing with works of art that have estates connected to them and so forth, it's a different matter. I wish there was something more to say about that.
Let me just put in a word for lawyers for a second. In many cases, lawyers are more progressive than museums about this.
Yeah.
Because an ordinary digitization of a two-dimensional object has no creativity and therefore adds no new copyright. So when you digitize a public domain work, the digital copy is itself in the public domain, and the permission has no right. I mean, the museum has no right to ask for permission before it can be reused. But that may be interested in your creative forms of digitization, like the dress that can be turned inside out.
Yeah.
Now there, it's up to the museum, and I'm wondering how you persuade museums to make those more freely available.
It's a real challenge, and you know the kind of model that I'm advocating here is also a model that pushes against the sort of top-down, you know, a top-down tradition that has very good reasons for being too. That's been about assuring quality. That's been about, you know, science, about rigor. So, you know, creating a more bottom-up or a kind of model that links the top-down to the bottom-up in a more, you know, dynamic way, it raises some fundamental institutional issues that I think are a challenge for the people who are in leadership positions. I think there's some museums, like the Brooklyn Museum, for instance, has opened all its APIs, and, you know, they'll let anybody go in and you know, play with, you know, their digitized archive. My position would be that that's the right way to go, you know, but not exactly.
We count on lots of copies to keep us safe. Then we also count on open content or licensing that makes that possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I see those very much as of a piece. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, one of the areas I just want to mention before we conclude here, that I think is really a challenging area, but it's really going to be a key area in terms of this future where the web is increasingly three-dimensional as well as two-dimensional, is the ability to seamlessly and quickly produce content for the 3D web. And one of the limitations, as you know, we've worked in Second Life, in working, you know, producing content in an environment like Second Life, is you can't just scan objects. You know, three-dimensional scanning has become a reasonably sophisticated technology at this point. It's not great in terms of the digital, the output files that you get. They're pretty messy files. They have a lot of irrationalities to them. But we're not that far away from a world where it might be conceivable that you could do pretty high-level three-dimensional scanning and just pop stuff up into three-dimensional environments on the web. And for museums, repositories that have large collections of objects, especially fragmentary objects, that's a world that's quite interesting, I think. I mean, it has tremendous potential. Because precisely for the preservation reasons as well. Because suddenly that's an object that has multiple lives. So if everybody can copy it, and if you have a scholarly community that's a global community that suddenly can doesn't now have to make a special trip to go to your repository, but can actually look at some of that stuff from a distance, look at other sets of stuff from a distance, and imagine things that can be done with it, not to mention the kind, you know, sort of research questions that those materials would sustain. I mean, that's a world that's a lot richer in terms of its possibilities than the one that we live in today. But there's still a step that's, you know, we're struggling with, which is how it should be just as easy to create 3D content as it is to pop a video up on YouTube. You know, and we're not quite there yet. I mean, that's the direction we've been working on. I mean, we think that that's going to be a big deal. We're about to close. I want to make a pitch, if I could, which is that the Tunnels Project is up for Italy's top design prize this year, which is for 2010, which is called Italian Oxygen. And we're looking for votes.
So, does that need to be Italian?
No. This is Abitare, which is the Italy's one of the leading design magazines, holds an annual competition, and we were one of the projects that was elected for the finalist group. Yeah.
Do you expect the Trento?
Yeah.
Do you expect those are going to become permanently an exhibition, a rotating temporary exhibition space?
Yes. The idea was to try out these multiple iterations of how they could be used. And eventually a permanent structure is going to be built there. One of the tunnels will be a kind of laboratory space, and the other tunnel will be a sort of exhibition space.
I'd be curious, because we've got an abandoned subway tunnel in downtown Boston that goes about a half a mile.
Really?
And
what's that?
Goes down from Wellston Street on
Lamont
Street toward the Mass Pike.
Yeah.
They have, like...
And I think somebody has actually proposed turning it into some sort of exhibition space.
Yeah.
Right now it seems it has like some old pieces of history that are parts of the MBTA's
right.
history.
Oh, that's right. Interesting.
That's just, wow. Yeah. That's just some station. And beyond there, yeah. It goes for like a half mile and it's unused.
Yeah.
Is it illuminated? Is it?
It could be.
I mean, what I'm saying is, does one need to go through it with a flashlight? Or
right now you would, yeah.
Right,
plus,
you would.
Plus there's no portal in the other end at the moment.
Right.
It could be open. But I'm just thinking, you know, looking at this as,
there.
You know, a model that could be used here. It's a much smaller scale tunnel than
right.
this, and it's, you know, a small subway tunnel, not a huge highway tunnel, but
right.
still.
Well, one thing I can tell you is it was amazing to me because we had no idea how successful this would be. In fact, the people who funded the project weren't so sure themselves. The people found walking through these highway tunnels to be absolutely a mesmerizing experience. We were far from sure that that would be the case. And you can see that we deliberately did not modify them. We left the asphalt. We used road signage as a sort of convention for the navigational system. And by doing that, people actually had a more intense experience of the space than they would have if you had intervened and chopped it up. And there's something really kind of cathedral-like about these spaces. So I think the subway tunnel could have its own expressivity.
Are you familiar with the abandoned tunnels on the Pennsylvania Turnpike?
No.
There's a whole section of the Pennsylvania Turnpike where tunnels were built. And then later they decided, you know, the tunnels were narrow, they were inefficient,
yeah.
And they didn't mind cutting into the hill and building over it instead of under it. So there are several miles of abandoned tunnels, which I think are there's some project that's sort of like trying to turn them into a bike path or something.
Huh.
But
yeah.
I sort of wonder what else could be done with them. There's probably other stuff like this around the country, but that's
yeah.
like one of those more well-known ones.
Makes me think way back. History, when they had cave paintings, it's almost a similar idea.
Yeah, they're really remarkably interesting. In Italian, there's a very fortunate coincidence between the word for gallery and the word for tunnel. They're the same word. So there's this kind of in
what's the word?
Galleria.
Okay.
It's the same word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in Italian,
it's also a shopping arcade.
Exactly,
yeah.
It's also a shopping arcade.
Milan, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So in Italian, it works particularly nicely.
Because the shape is
the same. Yeah. I guess, just because of the shape. Yeah, yeah. But there's something that what was very interesting as a sort of experience for us was just discovering how leaving the tunnel in its kind of raw state was much more powerful than anything you could do to kind of to try to normalize it in terms of an exhibition space. So in the second year, we decided to just follow exactly the same approach. In fact, I don't know if you can see in this photograph, there's actually, we used commercial highway materials to mark off the projection areas. In other words, like the safety strips with the yellow and black stripes. I mean, everything's done with those kinds of materials. Those montages with the letters are done with billboard. It's just like crude billboard painting, like the big panels that you see along the highway, glued to the wall. In other words, to go very low, kind of low tech, and to emphasize the rusticity of the space, not to try to fix it up and smooth it. And people actually liked that. It was interesting. They weren't yearning for something that was more, you know, kind of smooth and processed and museum-like.
I was wondering, how did such a fairly new piece of infrastructure get abandoned so quickly?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like it's in good condition.
Yeah.
Did they suddenly decide that nobody needed to drive there?
No. In fact, one of the things I omitted, you might have seen it in the film, is they actually just moved the highway about 100 yards away. It kind of swerved it away. And the motivation was safety reasons.
And built another tunnel?
Yeah. So there's another set of tunnels. So as you exit the black tunnel and turn around to re-enter the white tunnel, you're out in a space where you actually see the highway rushing by.
Because yeah. I mean, what they did, they built basically replaced the tunnel with non-tunnel.
Yeah. No, this is, and in fact, one of the continuations of this project is we're building two urban gardens. These tunnels run north and south. And the idea was to create a garden that represents the high alpine gardens of the Swiss-Austrian-Trento border on the north side, and on the south side to build a garden that's representative of the southern border of the region. So the idea was to create a kind of allegory of the region. These are teaching gardens. So all the plants are designed. They're built into cutouts in the asphalt. So you remember where they came from. So it's not concealing the nature of the site, but on the contrary, reinterpreting it so that this is a teaching space. So the exhibition contents interact with this sort of living garden. And at the far garden, where the northern garden, where the highway passes by, there's actually even going to be like a little dolomitic alpine landscape artificially constructed with the construction debris of the site. That was the idea.
When you're done, I'm going to show you this Pennsylvania thing.
Okay. Anyhow, we're running out of time, I think. But
excuse me. Are we done or we're done or not?
Well, no, we can keep talking until Amar gives me the...
Are you familiar with the virtual Los Angeles thing that they're doing?
Yeah. Hypercities?
Not Hypercities. I was just... I have a zillion links open here at the same time. But I discovered it at a digital archaeology thing they had at UCLA.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
those are friends of mine.
Yeah, I mean, it's great stuff. Jepson at UCLA. Beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
And I just went back and looked at the site, because like, nothing's happened in two or three years. So I'm wondering how you get persistence going with something like this.
It's a real challenge.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge. I mean, the UCLA project, actually the Hypercities project, which the archaeology project, I think, is...
I think it's
what
Digital Los Angeles...
Yeah, exactly.
Virtual Los Angeles.
It became part of the Hypercities project. The Hypercities project is a project we started back in at Stanford. We started it in 2002. And then one of the PIs for the project was hired at UCLA, and he took the project with him.
Okay.
And the virtual Los Angeles part of it was added in. It started out, the original name of the project was Hypercities Berlin.
Okay.
Because Berlin was the first city that we built it around. And the idea was, it was to do an experiment with what urban historiography might look like if you were not constrained by print as a medium. In other words, to take a geospatial approach and to try to create a kind of time slider-based model where maps could be used to assemble large data sets around actual full databases in some case, around the history of a single city. And then now Los Angeles has come in, and there's a couple of other city sites that are being developed.
So I've seen the Hypercities now, and I actually remember somebody from that giving that talk.
Yeah.
So has the virtual Los Angeles been subsumed back under Hypercities?
I think it's integrated into the Hypercities platform.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now Hypercities looks much more current.
Yeah, Hypercities continues to be built, and I don't know where the digital virtual Los Angeles project is, but we're actually working on the idea of taking the Hypercities project, taking it out into physical space. In other words, it's being built as a web-based resource, but the idea would be to take it out onto a handheld device that's GPS-based.
Really great to do with augmented reality. Part of this thing, by the way, is the sort of citizen involvement part of it is that you have an old picture of a building interior in Los Angeles. A friend of ours, Dan Neutra, his father's the Richard Neutra, and he has lots of stuff, and a lot of the buildings have been torn down, but he has like blueprints and things like that. So those are all things that can be put, say, on.
Exactly. You know. And there's a piece of the Los Angeles project now that involves communities, different ethnic communities, writing their own history on the Hypercities platform.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Wow. Yeah, there's a section that I think has just been, I think it's up there now on Koreatown in Los Angeles. We're working on the idea of developing for the Milan 2015 Expo, the next, you know, World's Fair.
Yep, they're, well, Filipino Town.
The Filipino Town,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Right,
that's
right.
That's what it is, yeah.
But it's a mobile media tour.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Of developing one in the city of Milan. So the idea is to use this platform to gradually build up these very thickly layered, dense kinds of histories of different cities, and then to link them across to databases and to be able to deliver them in a palm-held device of some kind.
To talk afterwards. But I want to thank you, Jeffrey.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.